From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Indie filmmaker Lynn Shelton wanted to make a movie with Marc Maron. But shockingly, at first, the comedian wasn't that cooperative.
I said, look, if you want to make a movie with me, why don't you just go write one? And I didn't think she would, but she did. She went and wrote this movie. She came back. She said, I got it. I drove by a pawn shop. Do you belong in one? With the other sad artifacts that people had to give up. And that's what it's going to be. We're going to shoot it in somewhere in the South. It wasn't Alabama initially. And I said, okay, sure, Lynn, that sounds like that's going to happen.
Turns out that did happen. In Shelton's new movie, Sword of Trust, Maron plays a pawnbroker who gets caught up in a scheme to sell a Civil War artifact of dubious provenance. As it happens, the thing is of great interest to a bunch of shady characters with very peculiar beliefs. Shelton and Maron tell us about making the movie in 12 days on location in Alabama and about shooting an extended, improvised, soul-bearing monologue in the back of a sweltering box truck for 9 hours. Maron swears he's not a diva on set, but he does understand how easy it might be to become one. But first on the news banter, will Leo roar again? Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So we are going to be flying a little blind here because Quentin Tarantino's latest opus, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, is opening, whether you're listening to a podcast or on the radio. We don't know yet how it's going to open. It's tracking okay. The critics, they like it, although I have to feel in some ways that they love Quentin Tarantino. And sometimes I get a feeling that critics grade on a curve for auteur directors that they've loved passionately. You know, I'm hearing mixed buzz. You've seen it and reached your own conclusions. The reason this is a big deal, though, is because this has been a summer that has been dominated by, first of all, Disney, and second of all, pre-branded, what they call IP, intellectual property. I hate that expression, but it has eclipsed the idea of movie stars. You know, the Avengers is greater than the sum of and the individual parts of anybody in the movie, with the possible exception of Robert Downey Jr. So this is a movie, on the other hand, it's an original that's got a movie star in it. It's a different kind of thing, and in some ways feels like a bit of a test for that notion.
Absolutely. And this isn't just a movie being sold as a movie star vehicle. I mean, it's a pretty tough movie. It's 2 hours, 40 minutes. You know, people are referring to it as a hangout movie. That's basically code for not much story. It's basically you go to see these movie stars hang out in a Quentin Tarantino universe. And especially it's a referendum on Leo DiCaprio. Leonardo DiCaprio has become one of the last real movie stars. And I say that meaning he can open a movie. The Revenant was a very bleak, violent, R-rated art house movie, and it did $500 and something million worldwide. There aren't many actors that can do that anymore. And Leo is of a different breed. He doesn't work very often. Revenant was his last movie and it was 2015. He's not out there every day on social media. You don't know much about him. He doesn't do sequels. He doesn't do pre-branded movies. He doesn't do franchises. He is making older style, star-driven art house movies, and they do hundreds of millions of dollars at the box office. And this movie really is a referendum on whether that's still a viable business.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to bet against Leo DiCaprio, and I think this movie probably will do fine. It is the most expensive, allegedly the most expensive movie that Tarantino made. I'm not sure they say it's about $90 million. I always round up like a lot. But I will note, it's a personality-driven thing how this business works in many cases. And Tom Rothman, who runs Sony Pictures, his passion to get a Quentin Tarantino movie for his studio was such that he made a deal. This is a guy who's famous for driving a very, very tough bargain. And he made a deal that is extraordinary, unprecedented, I think, among major studios, which is that it gives Quentin Tarantino ultimately, eventually, ownership of this film. I would think that would almost be against Tom Rothman's religion, except his other religion is his desire to be in this category of revered films. You know, he makes very commercial films like Jumanji and with Marvel's help, the Spider-Man movies lately, and they're successful. But what he really loves also is just movies, an old-fashioned movie like this. Giving away, ultimately, eventually, that ownership puts him in a club with George Lucas and Mel Gibson on The Passion of the Christ, which, of course, was totally outside of the studio system. And it speaks to the way personality drives things in this business, and also studios because they're not generally in the business of spending that kind of money on movies they don't own.
Yeah, I mean, if you think of someone like Tom Rothman, this is a guy who got into this business because he loves movies. And I'm sure it's kind of soul-crushing in a way when you're putting together your slate and you're like, okay, Jumanji 2, let's do it. You know, what are we going to do? What is the Spider-Man universe going to look like 5 years from now? How are we going to do Venom spinoffs and such? And, you know, he was able to now get out there in a round of press in advance of this movie and say, we are in the business of quality filmmakers. And he said very bluntly, we should not be giving up on this audience. And by this audience, he means people who like quality, who are adult oriented, are willing to sit for 2 hours and 40 minutes in a hangout movie and spend time. And, you know, it's not based on explosions or people in spandex. So I think that this, it speaks to the psyche of the people running the business that they want to at least have something to be proud of. And, you know, we see it in the Oscar race every year where the Oscar race gets so crazy because it's something for these people to talk about and be proud of when the rest of the year, they're not quite proud of what they're doing.
So let me pivot back to something we kind of touched on last week, which is Netflix. Right after we did the banter, Netflix reported that it had missed its projected growth in subscribers in the second quarter. They added up 2.7 million subscribers worldwide, as opposed to an anticipated 5 million. And wow, Wall Street reacted really badly.
Yeah, this was a big correction. I mean, Netflix lost about $24 billion in value in 6 days, according to the market. That's about 15% of the value of Netflix. And a lot of people have said, oh, this was coming. They couldn't have this trajectory forever. But it really did send a shockwave through town, I believe, because Netflix has been the darling and everybody has been trying to emulate what they're doing with this content spend. And they've been, you know, really spending like there's no tomorrow. And here you've got people now openly speculating, wait a second, what about this model? How long is this going to be able to go on? And if the market is not going to support the Netflix strategy, they're not making a whole lot of money. So they're going to have to pull back at some point.
Well, they are. We're seeing signs already of shows getting canceled. They just announced a couple, Designated Survivor and an animated series, Tuca and Birdie, which a lot of critics loved. You know, they just can't sustain the spend. I think that's been obvious from the start. And, you know, you say it's been the darling. It's been the darling and the demon. You know, people are terrified of Netflix. And I think that as much as people in the industry want there to be buyers, there's been so much fear around Netflix that maybe there's some feeling like, well, maybe this will right-size them, especially since they have had, to be honest, you know, the arrogance that comes with a digital background. Like, we're coming here in Hollywood, we're reinventing, we're showing you how we're going to do it is better. And, you know, little by little, it turns out there's some rational basis for the old ways.
Well, the thing with Netflix is they're preparing for a day when all of these other studios take back their shows. And we're seeing it already with Friends, with The Office. And this is only going to accelerate. By this time next year, Netflix will have major competitors in Disney, Warner Media, Apple, in addition to what's already out there with Hulu, which is owned by Disney now, and with Amazon. So if the market is pulling back in a pre-competition arena, what's it going to be like when there's real competition for streaming and for subscribers? And Netflix is really going to have to justify itself after having 7 or 8 years of a head start in this market.
Sorry, man. I was just checking if Disney also owns us now, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. In Lynn Shelton's new movie, Sword of Trust, Marc Maron plays Mel, a cranky, down-on-his-luck pawn shop owner in Alabama. Mel has been around, but even he doesn't know what to make of a sword that Cynthia, played by Jillian Bell, and her partner, Mary, played by Michaela Watkins, bring in to his shop. They claim it belonged to Cynthia's recently deceased grandfather and that it dates from the Civil War.
What battle are we talking about here?
This battle? Oh, it's Chickabauga.
Chickabauga?
Chickabauga.
I don't think that battle
is... Not familiar with it?
I don't think it happened.
Well, it happened.
Okay.
I assure you, 30,000 men lost their lives that day.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
You probably haven't heard of it because it's buried. Mm-hmm. It's not in history books.
What do you mean buried?
It is buried by Deep State.
Obviously, Mel doesn't buy that story, but then he finds out that some potential customers are very interested in the sword for some very strange reasons. Lynn Shelton's earlier work includes Hump Day and Your Sister's Sister. As with those films, much of the dialogue in Sword of Trust is improvised. Marin is a veteran stand-up comic with some improv experience and enough experience working with Shelton to trust her with Sword of Trust. Where did you kids meet?
She came to my garage.
I just dropped by his garage one day.
I interviewed her in 2015. Because I was interested in her and I seen some of her movies and she seemed like an interesting person. And we talked, we got along probably too well. And I asked her to direct a couple episodes of Marin in the fourth season. And that went well. It was the beginning of our relationship on camera and her behind the camera. And then coincidentally, she shows up on Glow. And at that point, I'm like, this lady's stalking me a little.
Even though I was hired before
he got cast. It was coincidental.
That's what you say.
It's true.
That you were hired before I was cast.
It's true.
That's her story.
Yeah, I get it. I'll check that out. But so as time went on, our creative relationship evolved. I asked her to direct my last comedy special, which she did. And we began writing a movie about 3 years ago. It's almost done. And in the middle of that process, she's like, I really don't know, you know, why you don't want to finish this. And I just have a hard time finishing things in general. You know, I'd like other people to do it for me. So I said, look, if you want to make a movie with me, why don't you just go write one? And I didn't think she would, but she did. She went and wrote this movie. She came back. She said, I got it. I drove by a pawn shop. You belong in one with the other sad artifacts that people had to give up. And that's what it's going to be. We're going to shoot it and somewhere in the South. It wasn't Alabama initially. And I said, okay, sure, Lynn, that sounds like that's going to happen. And then it did.
Lynn is just laughing here, not making noise. I just want my listeners to know this.
I was like, you know, like, when, where, how long is it going to take? And then it came down to 2 weeks.
That was what you had told me you would give me. That was why I shot it in 12 days, because I knew I had to do it in 12 days.
I don't want to sound like some sort of diva. Or some sort of like person that's sort of, I don't have the time to do that.
You're a busy guy.
I think there was some part of me that was like, is it going to happen? Are we going to do it? Here's 2 weeks. Try that, lady. That happen.
I see how fun it is for you to work with Mark all the time, right? He's so easy. Is he easy?
He's so easy.
Tell her the truth, Lynn.
If you know how to relate to a feral cat, then you're fine.
I got it. So this idea for this film that you had to make in 2 weeks because of the cat lover.
No, there was other issues. Don't hang it all on me.
And the other issues.
It's okay. It makes it easier to produce something and get a bunch of very highly, you know, employed other actors. Like the entire cast it's made up of people who are working constantly. And to ask them for 2 months, I never would have gotten them. But to call up and say, I got 2 weeks. I got a really fun project. Come
in
on
Alabama.
Out. It'll be like summer camp.
In the summer.
Very, very humid.
Yeah.
No, it was early May. I thought it would be a little more reasonable.
At least you didn't have to worry about their stance on choice at that time.
I know. I don't know what I would have done if they'd passed that heartbeat bill just before I had to shoot. If it had been this year, I would have been, I would have had to pull out.
Yeah. So you also, and I don't want to give my, I don't like to give away stuff about plot when I talk to people about projects, but there is a conspiracy at the heart of this film or a belief in a legend that is a little not sane. And this was inspired by a Lyft ride that you took.
Yes. Yes, it's true. It was a long Lyft ride, and the driver and I had a very normal seeming conversation. It seemed like just happy banter, small talk. Totally normal, regular guy. Seemed intelligent, of average intelligence at the very least. At the end of this ride, he starts to describe to me a theory that I couldn't grasp he was being serious about, and I didn't know why he was talking about this absurd thing that obviously he wasn't serious about, which was that the earth was flat. And I had yet to discover that this was a whole thing, that this is an actual movement that has had a recent resurgence in the cultural narrative, which is really still astounding to me. But at the time, I had no idea it even existed. I thought it was just this one kook who was driving me back to my apartment. And when I finally realized that he was absolutely serious, I had this look on my face that I couldn't control. That was, you're cuckoo bananas. And he parked the car and he turned around from the front seat and he looked at me and he said, look, I know exactly how you feel. I was exactly where you are a year ago. All you have to do is Google it. Just keep Googling it. It's all there. It's irrefutable fact. And, you know, just do me that favor. And I needed to put that in a movie. As soon as I walked out of that car, I realized, oh, that is totally going in a movie.
That was the portal into the stupid.
I want to know if it affected the rating when you rated the ride. Did you be like, well...
Nice guy, delusional. It's only a matter of weeks before he starts asking for money.
I know. I was going to say, any minute now.
Yeah, we should keep that under the
demand
lid.
Letter arrives.
I was the guy.
Now, there's a scene in this movie. Mark, you do this monologue. And you guys are, I'll just say, you're in a truck, which sounds so fun in the summer.
It was horrendous. It was a horrendous day. We thought it was going to be a good day because it was in a studio. We were going to get relief from the heat, but that was not the case. The air conditioning didn't work. It wasn't good. And we're in a truck. So we're in a hot studio in a hot truck.
For about 9 hours.
9 hours.
In the back, not in the driver's, sitting next to each other, in the carpeted back.
But
in this nasty truck.
Sitting on a very hard wheel wells.
Yeah. And this is basically, Lynn, there's no script for this thing, except what was it? The direction
it said,
was something
they get
like
to know each other.
They get to know each other in the van.
Yeah.
Right. So then everybody kind of talks about themselves.
Yes. And we had worked out some of that backstory before we got there, but the details all came
in. Did you improvise?
No, I mean, I improvised all of that. Lynn and I had discussed, you know, where this guy's from and kind of came up with a bit of backstory because I think the initial...
Well, let me stop you for one second. I want to say this. This is, to be clear, so people understand, it is a dark, soul-bearing monologue, basically.
But then, yeah, but it's heartfelt. It is dark, but I think the humanness of it transcends the darkness because it is in the context of a movie that's kind of bubbling along at a pretty funny clip.
Right.
And you do get to know these characters pretty well.
Yeah, it has been super funny.
Yeah.
And then we're in the truck.
But it's like when I watch it again and again, the way that the monologue sort of unfolds and then the way we come out of it, it kind of has a nice flow thanks to Lynn's editing and my spontaneity. But the backstory, I think the intention initially was, I don't believe that when I was told I'm going to be a pawn shop owner in Alabama, that I had any desire to do an accent. You know, I'm getting better at acting, but I'm not at the point
where...
You're not
Meryl Streep at
this stage. I'm not going to put on weight or learn a dialect.
Right.
So we had to sort of figure out how he got down there. And through bits and pieces of my life and through bits and pieces of ideas I had and that we talked about, you know, how he would get there and what had happened, we came up with sort of a pretty good backstory. But once I got in the truck and we started running this thing, I started integrating, you know, it's about heartbreak, it's about addiction, it's about deeply codependent relationship with Lynn's character, who you see a few times in the film. So I was able to integrate a lot of my personal experience, but also sort of project a little. I've gotten better. Maybe it was because it was so hot in the truck. Maybe I was somewhat delusional. But I spent a lot of time in the 80s on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and I was clean at the time. You know, I'm coming up on 20 years sober.
Congratulations.
I think next week. But back then, I lived in a very sort of heroin-ridden neighborhood, and I used to see the same people come down the street every day to score. And something because I used bits and pieces of the Lower East Side in the monologue, and that was from, you know, my living there at that time and me sort of wondering about these people's lives and then placing myself in them. So I was able to kind of utilize these made-up memories to inform that monologue. But I think we did it a lot, and it kept kind of evolving. And I think, if I'm correct in saying, Lynn, that was the close-up was from the last shot of the day.
One of the very last shots, for sure, yeah. And every time we did a take of the entire scene, it probably ended up being about 40 or 45 minutes long because everybody had a backstory that it ended up getting winnowed down a lot in the edit room. But it was a very long scene for everybody to go through, and we had to figure out how to bridge from one story to the next and how to set up the next story and so on. And so by the time we got to Mark's coverage in that close-up, he'd found a nice groove for that story, and that was the best take of it. But the most amazing thing is that at that point, he was so aggravated and so
really?
Angry and so exhausted and hot, and he was able to channel all of that negative energy into this really beautiful, poignant, you know, performance.
I'm a master of channeling negative energy. It's one of my specialties.
Sometimes it's great good.
In my stand-up, in my day-to-day life, I can just take negative energy and magically make it funny or emotionally resonant.
Yes, yeah. Poignant.
Yeah, poignant. That's a good word.
Coming up after a short break, Mark Maron tells us about taking a role in the upcoming Joker movie, despite dissing superhero films in the past. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to writer and director Lynn Shelton and comedian, podcaster, and actor Mark Maron about their new comedy, Sword of Trust. The film was shot in just 12 days in Alabama last year. Maron plays Mel, a Birmingham pawn shop owner who, along with a couple played by Jillian Bell and Michaela Watkins, hatches a scheme to make some much-needed money off a sword that may or may not have been used in the Civil War. Their plan seems to be working until a character that could have come straight out of Deliverance, played by Toby Huss, shows up.
Come on, Mr. Mel, let you and me take a ride.
Should we just follow in our car, or?
No, you're not going to follow nothing. It's me and Mel. Come on, get that gun. Let's go.
No, it can't. Sorry, because he's my husband.
I guess we're all going. We're all going,
yeah,
baby, right?
We all have to go because...
I can't fit but one in here.
No, listen, I know how it goes. You start your moonshine. He's 3 days sober. Pastor Eric is not having it. I'm not having it. I'm going with.
So when you have your two-week idea and you've got, I assume he's in. I don't know how much of the cast you had put together, but who do you go and finance it with somebody? Or
yeah, so I got
mean,
all the cast
for itself,
pretty much the core cast attached. Because I knew I wanted it to be improvised, and there's only a certain... I had a very highly curated list of people that I knew could actually do it.
Right.
So I had a lot of those people in place. And then I had some, you know, people like my director of photography and my editor and folks like that in place, a composer who I ended up... Some of these people ended up changing because he ended up doing all the music, so I had to let the composer go on this one. But
Mark played the guitar.
Yes, he did. We had a 50-page scriptment, the document, the shooting document that we had, you know, on hand, and then like a top sheet of a budget. And we took that and put it into kind of a nice, we had a designer create a nice pitch deck, they call it, I found out, to sort of
you didn't
create
have
a
that before?
Pitch book. No, I didn't know that phrase. And we presented to probably, I want to say maybe 8 financiers who we thought would be a good fit. And I think 4 or 5 of them wanted to make the movie with us. It was really, it was really great. And I went with the one that said, we'll write you a check and leave you alone. And
choice.
Yeah, it was a really easy pick. Yeah. And
I mean, Swanberg, I don't know, were the other guys saying, well, we should get a different pawnbroker. The other guys wanted
metal. Oh, yeah. No, they all wanted to get their fingers in there somehow, you know, and they wanted final cut or they wanted to have cast approval or, and it was just like, no.
No.
And there were only 2 that were willing to give me the kind of creative freedom that I really wanted. And I just, Joe Swanberg and Eddie Linker and Peter Gilbert have this company called Forager Films. And Joe is an old friend of mine. We've known each other for at least a dozen years as fellow filmmakers. And when he told me that he would really literally just, they would leave me alone, I really believed him.
And he did.
And he did.
Joe's another maverick, does things by himself. You know, he definitely understood
the
deal.
Yeah, he knew. Yeah.
It's kind of encouraging because we're living in this world where, and I know, Mark, you've been a little bit dragged by some people because you did the Joker and you said superhero movies. I don't know what you said about superhero. You said something about superhero.
I say a lot of things about superhero movies, but now I've sort of framed my role in the Joker movie. I was very specific about the Marvel universe. And here's my rationalization that it's a DC movie. And I think that's really...
And those have been so... different in that they make less money.
Yeah, exactly. I went with the starving artists. You know,
right.
Like DC is a struggling
inspiring
franchise.
And
their superheroes, I think, are more dark and human. But the truth is, the script doesn't read like a superhero movie. And I'm not justifying
it's a very
that.
Just
look at the trailer.
Yeah. I mean, it's Joaquin like Phoenix and Robert De Niro.
Well, yeah, so I got that call. Yeah. Hey, Todd Phillips says, you want to do this scene? I had auditioned for a small part because they were looking at comics because there's a subtext of comedy in that. And he asked me if I would do this other part where I had a scene with De Niro and Joaquin Phoenix. I'm like, you know, I'm not really, you know, superhero movies or
right.
Like that was going to happen. You know, let me think about it because I've said some stuff publicly. I've offended a lot of the nerd community and it's just going to leave me vulnerable to their trolling.
Yeah.
So I did it.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, I can, having written some things, the nerd community, they get offended easily and they attack energetically.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But having said that, we do see Disney eating up the whole thing and superhero movies upon superhero movies. And
it's like a plague.
And the idea that you had multiple people willing to finance this movie, even though some of them wanted to put the strings on, I'm honestly surprised.
Yeah, well, I wasn't asking for $200 million.
I'm sure you weren't.
Which
I'm
really
sure
helped.
Or probably a, yeah.
I even put some of my own money into it. It was a responsibly budgeted film.
Music and was very expensive.
The music was extremely. That was, yeah, that was.
Is there a thing, actually, when he sort of then becomes the music person, does that create, like, oh, now it's got to be ASCAP or,
yes, he had to, it had to be.
Yeah,
AMI,
but you do
ASCAP
have to, yeah, you do have to sign up for ASCAP. But I think I charged $1 per thing. The last song we put some money in.
Yes, we put all
we
the money into
that.
We did
do a studio bit for
created
Under the Credits.
A brand new...
I wrote something with Tal Wilkenfeld, and she brought in a bunch of studio people, and that was an exciting day. There,
I was going to say that it was like a completely new thing for you.
Yeah, it was a little daunting, you know, because Doyle Bramhall was there, who's a wizard, and so it took me a few takes to ease up.
Calm. What do you do? You go in there with some kind of...
Oh, no, I wasn't freaking out. I was excited. You know, it's like, it's pretty easy to calm me down. You know, like there was some issue with the cereal. It was...
It was a funny moment because on set, he
I just
he
wanted
kept,
this one
this
kind
was
of
how it started.
Cereal.
I
am
understand
not
that.
A
I...
diva.
Yes,
I am not
I
a diva.
I understand this. I am wanted to... That no, was right now, cereal. I'm not going to criticize you for this. Go ahead.
Yeah,
but, no, but
no,
it was one of these things. I was eating a certain
just
way, and
funny.
you want some consistency when because you on set.
Yes,
and it wasn't a tough product. I don't eat cereal anymore. That was back in the day. Now, because cereal is no good for me anymore. But it's just a comfort thing, you know. And I just couldn't understand why they couldn't get me this cereal.
It's amazing how quickly that happens, though,
what,
right? You're
getting,
that guy, like that fast.
Well, you realize this is how it happens. That's the seed of it. Like I never understand these stories when I hear them. It's like, how could someone become
but you
that
do now.
Big?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean. For me, it was just cereal, and I felt bad. I had to apologize for people. I'm like, I wasn't that big a deal, but I just want. But like that can grow once you get entitled and you become needed and you make people a lot of money.
Yes.
You know, how could cereal not become, I need you to deliver a car to the set every day, a different one, so I can drive home in a different one. Just because I feel like.
And this is all I ask of you.
Yeah.
I'm
that's
not
that
a
big
diva.
A deal.
I'm not
a,
but I do understand, honestly, I have had insight by being around the stuff that when
cereal?
You are when you I'm definitely that but you are carrying a show
right.
The pressure is killing, especially when you're a star. A lot of times you don't even know quite why, and that you're afraid all the time,
I
like
guess, yeah.
The thing will leave me
right.
And therefore you're under so much pressure that you say all I'm asking of you is this damn different car every day, and why can't you do that for me?
Just make my fear go away for a minute by appeasing me. Well, fortunately for me, I never think I'm a star of any kind. And Lynn kept telling me I'm the lead of this movie. And I'm like, doesn't seem like it. There's a lot of other people here. And I don't know how this is going to cut together where
I'm
the lead.
How do I get a word in edgewise?
Yeah, the first couple of days were rough because I don't do broad improvising. I'm not like a guy who does character improvising. I improvise great within my emotional
within
wheelhouse.
Are, yeah.
So like I had these people that were just going at it. And the first day I was like, this isn't going to work out. Pull these people down to earth so they become real people so I can be a real person among them. If that doesn't happen, I'm just going to be the straight guy, which it turned out I kind of am, but it was also an emotional anchor.
Well, yeah, somebody has to.
Yeah, and maybe she knew I was going to do that anyways, but I had no choice.
Mark Maron is the star and Lynn Shelton is the director of Sword of Trust. Thank you guys so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us,
Kim.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.